lifestyle choices, and environmental factors impact your brain health and the physiology and psychology of your mental health. When you're ready to turn your brain on to get your game on, listen to In Your Head Radio. Now here's your host, Lee Richardson.
Thanks for being with me today. Today I've got a really interesting show. I've got John Aidan Byrne, and he's an award-winning journalist. He's an editor. He's a filmmaker. He's got two projects currently in development. He's the host of Odin Capital Conversations, the number one podcast on capital markets with Matt Van Alstyne, and host of the top-ranked Dig Life Deep podcast featuring Ira Wolf's Future Shock. He's a highly innovative writer. He's an editor. He's conceived and structured award-winning publication ventures. He's earned recognition from the publishing community while significantly improving revenues and circulation. He's a versatile reporter with strong expertise and relationships in the financial and technology markets that have resulted in significant growth for a leading trade magazine and other B2B publications. He's been published by the New York Post, the Time Warner, the Wall Street Journal, just to name a few. John Aidan, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm falling off my chair. I'm so flattered. We got off to a great start.
Yes, we did. And we're just getting started. So it's so interesting to me because having a podcast, I have met such interesting people and I have had such great guests. And I was looking at your website and it took me back because one of the best guests I've ever had on my show was a rabbi. He actually, he had me singing and chanting and had so much fun. And I was scrolling through yours. I'm like, oh, he's had a rabbi too. I don't know if that's been your most interesting guest, but talk to us a little about your podcast. Let's talk about Dig Life Deep.
Okay, well, Dig Life Deep came about 2.5 or so years ago. It was, we were in COVID at that point, or maybe it a little bit before COVID. And but COVID propelled it because just life changed so radically. And I figured I needed a new direction in life in addition to what I was already doing. But some things just got shut down. And, this was a new creative venture. And as the title says, Dig Life Deep, I always wanted to do that. I wanted to have really interesting, no-holds-barred conversations with really interesting people, that rabbi, entertainers, authors, filmmakers, scientists, business people, CEOs, people maybe who are struggling in life and have overcome various obstacles. Because, you know, the media, mainstream media, is so fragmented and fractured, and it's a lot of the time just driven by ratings and entertainment. Whereas the approach I take gives me an opportunity to ask questions you might not ordinarily get, you know, on more faster paced mainstream media channels, you know, which are running by the clock. Some of my podcasts have run on, you know, past the hour or so, and somebody says something that gets my attention, I can just probe a little further.
So what gets your attention?
Life, people's crisis, people's ambitions, people's goals, people who have struggled and come up from adversity, the problems of a world war, why do we go to war? It's sort of irrational. Is there a better way of doing this? Science, artificial intelligence, creativity in general, novel writing, screenwriting. What drives people? I mean, that's probably the biggest thing. What drives people? What separates those who just do the ordinary, which is the vast majority of our population, and some do it really well, and those who do the extraordinary? And the conclusion I have is the ones who do extraordinary things are driven. And then if you dig a little deeper on that, you'll find that they've had a fascinating, sometimes a difficult background in life, or maybe they were, you know, encouraged to succeed, but they're driven people. Sometimes it comes up, it's born of poverty. Sometimes it's born of special circumstances.
Well, we have a few interests in common, and one for me is the effect that crisis has. And I just completed my PhD in my dissertation, and it was on the lived experiences of organizational leaders in decision-making crises. And because looking at, you know, how just using their situational awareness, being agile, using critical thinking skills, how all of that impacts how they react and how they handle in a crisis. And I think in the world that we live in, we're all going to experience a crisis.
That's a great comment. And, you know, we don't hear enough acknowledgement of that by public leaders and even by parents or school leaders, teachers and professors. We sort of have drifted into a world where people are being told they shouldn't expect any pain in life, you know, that there's no challenge, that, you know, that we all inevitably face some kind of an obstacle and we have to overcome that. But the new paradigm in that is no, there should be no pain, no suffering. And, you know, it's kind of unnatural to suffer and have pain. I think that's what separates past generations from, you know, a lot of the cohort in the new generation, which is not to condemn or attack young people and paint them all with the same brush. But, you know, we're hiding people from reality a lot in a way that's kind of disturbing.
Well, I think that reality does exist, and it doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter what you were born into. We are all going to experience crisis on some level. I mean, it may be as simple as, you know, my dad died when I was 12 years old. And a lot of people, that happens to a lot of people, but that was a crisis for me. And that taught me a lot about how you deal with life in general. And I look in, you know, when we had the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, I'll never forget, I was listening to the radio and Governor Abbott came on and said, all businesses that are non-essential must close. And I knew I had to close. And immediately I thought, well, when am I going to reopen? And am I going to reopen? And if I do reopen, will anybody come? And that's really what prompted my thoughts for my dissertation topic, because I had several clients that were owned businesses and we were closed for 5 weeks. And when we came back and I was talking with them about, you know, so what are you going to do with your restaurant? What are you going to do with your business? And they really struggled making decisions. So everybody is going to be touched by crises. And I have two boys. I would love to tell them that they won't be. But it sounds like you and I are on the same page there.
Yeah, we protect our young too much, I think. And, you know, we could dig deeper on this and go down a rabbit hole maybe. But, you know, even our government policies, while a lot of the time well-meaning, there's a serious unintended consequences which are not good for the long-term well-being of society. You know, it gets controversial, but you know, we could start with, you know, the explosion in the welfare state and in all the various state agencies which are there to help people. But I think, you know, there should be a stronger emphasis on self-empowerment and people taking ownership, you know, for their own particular challenges. And at the same time, there are people who can come to their assistance and help them through work through difficult times. But you know, people have to take ownership of what the problems is. If, you know, if they have a financial crisis, you know, if they lose a job, you mentioned COVID there, or they lose their parent, you're going to have to work through all that grief yourself and get through it.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we all, when I look at people in general, I own a business, the Brain Performance Center, and we work with a lot of individuals that have a dysregulated brain. And all that means is maybe they suffer from anxiety or depression or their neurodivergent brain, ADHD or autism. But, you know, they all, there are things that we see on the level. We see their behavior. And then at the Brain Performance Center, we'll dig a little bit, we'll go that next level down, and we'll get into their thoughts and their feelings, and hopefully another level down, their beliefs, and then eventually get to that core identity. What do they value? What are they afraid of? What are they hoping for? What's their purpose? But it's oftentimes people don't want to go that deep.
That's real interesting, and the world. If you look at the statistics, and you know, you just look at the evidence, and some of it may also be anecdotal. Our society, our Western world, America, Europe, and so on, appears to be going through just an explosion in mental health related issues. You listed off a lot of the issues and phenomena there. And I thought about that, you know, as you get older and you mature and you have your own crisis, we all do, as you pointed out so rightly, we get back to issues like basic humility and looking at yourself in the mirror, and then issues of self-confidence and just pride even. You know, some people have to be talked down, you know, from a height. And so some people get there, and sometimes it takes a crisis to push them in that direction. And others go through life oblivious to the fact that inside themselves, they have the solution to be mentally and maybe physically a lot better.
Well, and I think a lot of that, you know, all behavior is learned. And if we learn as we grow up that there are no options or we don't have capabilities, it limits our thinking. But here's the good news. Everything that's learned can be unlearned.
Yeah. You know, over the years, I've worked with different people, you know, in the creative arts and business community. And it's no different in other sectors. The problem of addictions and alcoholism and so on. And I've always felt great sympathy and empathy for these people. Some of them have been the most driven people I've ever met in my life. And then my mind gets confused and muddled. Why then are they destroying themselves with alcohol and drugs? And, you know, I've learned some of it is a substitute for something in their life, that they're making up for some kind of a deficit. And they only discover that through maybe counseling, a very deep crisis where they, you know, where they have to look themselves in the mirror, or, you know, being guided by wonderful organizations like Alcohol Anonymous, which lays a stress on people seeking out a higher purpose or higher power, having a meaning in life. And, you know, that could be what's going on too. Some people, their meaning in life at one part of their life is drugs, alcohol, money, gambling, whatever, promiscuity. And then they learn later on that, no, it's something a lot deeper, richer, maybe more spiritual.
Absolutely. And I would like to add another component in there, and that is addiction is a brain disease. Not everybody's brain is wired and is firing that they can have two glasses of wine, or go gamble the $300 that they said they would gamble. Addiction is a brain disease. So, and this is something I've had conversations about. Yes, there is a lot of bad choice involved in that, but there's some neurological, there's some neurobiological involved in that too.
I have heard that, and that it disabused my original idea that I used to have that, you know, people who succumb, let's say, to alcoholism, oh gosh, they could have controlled that, or, you know, they're just indulging, and they as a substitute for something missing in their lives. But I've heard that repeatedly also from experts that there's something neurological, but there's also, I believe, in terms of alcoholism, and I don't know if the data is reliable, but there's a cultural phenomenon there. You know, different cultures have tend to have a higher rates of addiction in certain areas. I'm Irish, I'm American, also Irish American. There's a high rate of alcoholism in the Irish American community. I'm told that in other ethnic groups, it could be gambling. You know, so there is that component, a component as well, that the culture can reinforce an addictive issue.
Well, and another way to look at that is genetics. There's four things that puts a brain in a dysregulated state. Genetics is one of them. So, but you know, you've had some really interesting experiences, and I'm going to shift gears on you. But I know you worked for the family of the late actor, Carol O'Connor. And oh my gosh, All in the Family. How many times when you just needed a good laugh? Tell me, what was it like working with him?
Well, I worked with the family. I worked with his mom, Elise, who's now deceased, you would assume, obviously. And then and Carol's uncle, Jim. So I didn't work with Carol directly, but when I came to America, one of the first gigs I had was working for the family. They had a newspaper. They had an Irish-American newspaper, the O'Connors. They're fascinating people. And they have a history of producing like intellectuals and giants of literature and so on. So they had this interesting, colorful Irish-American newspaper called the Irish Advocate, and they ran it inside a travel agency in Queens. I just stumbled in one day because I was told they were running a newspaper, and I told Elise about my background and so on, and she, you know, they give me some work as a columnist and other duties. I was not aware of his fame, you know, because I grew up overseas, and I guess they weren't syndicating All in the Family in Ireland. But, you know, I told my cousin about it, and her jaw dropped. Just what? You know, she said, get me an autograph, please. But I remember Elise also having conversations with Jim on the phone, and that was kind of interesting. You know, they were very close, and a great family.
Well, it's so interesting because I can't tell you how many families all across America watched All in the Family. And and I think that it was such a realistic, you know, it wasn't the perfect family. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. Everybody was just right and beautiful and the smartest. Everybody was so real. And who couldn't enjoy and share a laugh? Particularly with Archie. What a grump.
Yeah, you said that correct. And a certain dysfunction in that family, you would say?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
and Edith, you know, she was so interesting because you thought, in the beginning, I thought she's a milquetoast. Then you push her buttons and you see Miss Edith come alive.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, it was realistic and it hit a chord. You know, it was down to earth and well scripted. But I was reminded recently that a similar show would not air today because we live in different times.
Probably it, wouldn't.
You know,
well, how about, well, how about
wouldn't
Modern
be politically
Family?
Correct.
How about Modern Family? Because to me, that's more of a today show.
Right. Yes. It's true. I mean, there are spin-offs and variations of All in the Family, but there's no clones of All in the Family.
No, there's not. So is when you think back over your career and you think back, you know, you've done a lot of podcasts. Who are some of your memorable people? I mean, what memories do you have? Because I know we all have memories. As I said, I mean, when I hadn't thought about Rabbi Dossick in years, and he wrote the book, Living Judaism. And so, I mean, we just all have those memories. What come to mind for you?
Well, thank you for singling out the rabbi interview that you took great delight in. And that to me was very special, because I like to interview people across different faiths, because we're all tied at the hip. Ultimately, we're all sharing the same space, and you know, we all have the same challenges, and so we have to kind of some kind of unity of purpose and some kind of a higher meaning. And certainly, people like rabbis have a higher, you know, they have a higher power out there. Jarvis Rockwell initially, you know, comes to mind. He's the son of the legend Norman Rockwell. And Jarvis is now in his 90s. And I got the opportunity to interview him because my friend Steve Haggerty, known as St. Haggerty, has just published a book on Norman Rockwell's models. And Norman Rockwell is the theme of one of the movies I have in development. Jarvis was fascinating because of his blunt nature, his kindness, his charitable outlook, and his deep insights into his dad, which I was never aware of. You know, he made it very clear that his father was, I suppose, complicated. There was the public image and the private image. And he was, in effect, he was a workaholic who devoted vast amounts of his weight, of his daily life, just to simply to work, perhaps, possibly to the detriment of his family. But that would be an open question.
Well, that's certainly a name that everyone knows. And, you know, I think he's represents a period in time that was very unique in the development of the United States.
Oh, yes. And there's a great nostalgia factor for Norman Rockwell today. And his popularity has not waned. It's flourished, as a lot of people want to go back to that. Kind of, we can't reinvent the past, but we can, you know, we can take inspiration from it, and we can celebrate the best of the past. And so there's a big nostalgia factor for Norman Rockwell, the rustic and urban scenes he portrayed. And it gives people a lot of peace and calm, I think, in a very volatile and turbulent world. When they say, well, this is the way it was, and maybe on some level it could be like that again, where there's, you know, maybe more mirth and joy and unity.
I think unity is a very interesting word. And I think it's one thing that we're lacking. We've become very divided over time, and we're divided over gender. We're divided over the most basic elements. And I think that's something that we all long for, and I would love to have more unity in society.
Yeah, I agree. And why are we so divided is a question that is difficult to answer. My thoughts on that is that we've entered a new era of moral relativism, in a sense, in that some of the things that kept us strong, kept us together, kept us intact as communities, as families, as government, was a belief in certain values. And now everything is kind of constantly debated. You know, something that was agreed and respected a generation ago is now not agreed and respected by vast amounts of the population. You know, we have just a society run rampant. We have a divided political body, obviously. We have had violence in our streets. We have this crazy situation of, you know, somebody can walk into a store in New York and California and walk out and not be prosecuted, you know. And then you mentioned all the wars over identity and gender and so on. We have divisions on what is the definition of a righteous and a proper economy, you know. Is free enterprise our enemy? You know, or is socialism the way to go? I mean, these are very deep questions, but we need to come together. And so I guess when I look, you know, at where America is today and where Europe is at today, you can see evidence of this great challenge we have, the extremist ideologies on both the left and on the right in America and in Europe. And I don't know. I don't think it has to be that way. I think we'd all be better served if there was some common ground, where there was some more consensus, there was less entrenchment. I mean, it's one of the reasons, I think, where we have a financial crisis. We can't agree on how to deal with the debt, $34 trillion national debt, and then unfunded liabilities. You know, we can't agree on how to deal with the border. We can't agree on do we send money overseas, because everybody has polar opposite views on this. I mean, there should be some basic ideas that we all agree on and then move forward. But those basic ideas have all broken down, I think, in our present climate.
I think you're right. And the really sad thing is I'm not sure that we know how to fix it. I think we all have our personal opinions on mm-hmm. what needs to be done. But I don't know that we have a solution that will work within the system.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think contributing to this in an odd and weird way is the advances and the prevalence and the pervasiveness of social media, 24/7 communications and miscommunications. People are glued into this. And so the so-called fake news and real news and bad news and all these tribes and different websites and different blogs and everybody trading barbs and trading conspiracy theories and real theories. So that doesn't help at all. In fact, speaking of that, I was part of a small community project, maybe 15 years ago, where we proposed people just shut off of social media for 24 hours and see is their life any better, you know, or, you know, come together as families and communities, do things and clear the mind of clutter. You know, it might not be such a bad idea.
I think it's a great idea. And I think, you know, it's one of the things that frustrates me the most is when I go out to a restaurant any kind of restaurant, and you'll look at a table of four and they're all looking at their phone. And I want to walk over and say, hey, who's that lady sitting across from you? Or, hey, you know, did you notice the plants when you walked in? Because we are so absorbed. We are addicted. You talk about addiction. My biggest fear for addiction is social media.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just mind-boggling how far this has gone. you go into those restaurants and so on. And then, I mean, it's just also rich with irony. People making all these friends on Facebook and on other platforms, and it's long distance friendships. It's superficial, really. They're not real friends. They're not like friends you had a generation ago where you were playing in the park, or you met them in the store or church or on Main Street. You know, they are two-dimensional friends, you know.
Well, and you know, you think about it, we've taken that. You're talking about meeting people. I have a very good friend, and she is single, and she's on the dating apps, and gets very frustrated with them. And I'm not much help because I've been married for a very, very long, long time. And that's something I'm proud of. But I talked to her the other day, and she's like, "Oh my gosh, I met somebody the old fashioned way." And I'm like, "Well, what is that?" And she's like, "It was in church. I sat next to him." And I'm like, "Oh, well, what do you know?"
Yeah. Well, that's a beautiful romantic story, a good hallmark series or movie. But there's less and less of that. And the other thing, of course, these are all communication tools, supposedly. And the communication skills are actually in decline because people really don't know how to communicate in the way they did a generation or two ago, because they're so hooked into all these social media platforms.
Well, and I really think that a big part of that is they've forgotten how. During the pandemic, we were so shut down. We were pushed to go in, you know, insular, go inside. I mean, you'll go to school on Zoom. You don't go to work. You work from home. You don't go to church. The churches are closed. You do that online. And I think that I noticed in Dallas when we all started coming back after that 5 weeks, and Governor Abbott said you can go back to work, some of you. And I noticed that, okay, there's a lot of people on the street, and the road rage was so intense. And I did a couple of radio shows on it, and I said, honestly, I think people just forgot how to play nice. You know, they were the only one on the road for so long. They didn't have to play nice, and they forgot how to do it. So I think that applies to our communication as well. And if use it or lose it, that's the way the brain works. If you're not using it, you're going to lose it.
Well, there's been studies done on this, and I'm not the expert, but on social media and this whole addiction and to number of people who are liking your posts and clicking and all of that dynamic. I mean, it's just fueling very fractured and broken egos. Because a lot of the social media is, you know, that's the way they try to hook a lot of users by saying, oh, you're getting a lot of attention on your latest post, or you've got, you know, 40 likes or 100 likes or something. And that sort of perpetuates that whole internal dynamic in people where they, oh, I've got to go back on. And, you know, they're never quite satisfied. But it's truly remarkable.
Well, John Aiden, there's more going on with that than you think. I did some radio interviews last week about brain popping and what has happened to the brain when people are they are addicted to social media. And our attention span has gone, on the average, a couple of years ago, we could hold attention 2.5 minutes. It's gone down to 30 seconds now.
My gosh.
So it's more, you know, it's more than just the emotional dysregulation. Nobody likes me. Nobody clicked. Nobody responded. To the mental, how it's affecting our cognitive processes, how it's affecting our ability to concentrate, to stay on task, to finish what we start. So it's reaching a point where it's going to get national attention, and it needs to. It absolutely does. And I think that for, you know, I almost, the people in the schools, the public schools, they're, I admire, my mom was a teacher, so I probably have some natural bias there, but I so admire what they do. And because teaching in today's world has got to be, I mean, a very different experience than it was.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to pick up on something you said about attention spans, because I was at a creative meeting for a marketing advertising campaign recently, and I was talking to somebody who's very advanced training on advertising and trailers and sending out posts on the various social media platforms, and she kind of she collaborates just what you said, you know, these they're becoming shorter and shorter trailers and snippets that you can only hold people's attention for multiple seconds, whereas maybe in the past you could have done it a lot longer. People won't stay watching these exhibits much longer than a multi-second period, and it's truncated compared to maybe 10 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Used to, you know, you would have your 30-second elevator pitch. Now that's an 8-second elevator pitch. And research shows that's all you got, man. You got 8 seconds. Mm. You better get it all out. You know, and we've really, just at the end of the podcast, we've really gotten into some of the challenges that are facing the United States and the Western part of the world. And in the last, you know, 3 or 4 minutes we have, is there anything that we haven't touched on that you feel our listeners, that you'd love to share with our listeners?
No, this has been a fascinating conversation, and we had nice back and forth, and you've got me thinking more deeply about the questions we've explored. I appreciate being on, and I did mention that 2 movie projects coming up, and in its own way, these will explore, you know, the big picture things of our time, relationships, community, interaction. One of them's on the life and times of a remarkable CEO, inventor, philanthropist, who founded a Wall Street company, long retired, but he grew up in an era where there was no social media, whereas, you know, there were probably better times on some level, but maybe more difficult times. So we'll be exploring those themes, and I'm glad we had this opportunity to get into those thoughts.
Well, me too. We've got about 3 minutes left. I know you mentioned the couple of movies projects that you have coming up. You also have a third podcast that's going to be coming out soon too. Is that correct?
Yes, I was in discussions with a business college in New York City, and they want me to start up a podcast on the, well, let's call it broadly speaking, the trading markets for students, Wall Street professionals, people in the trading markets. So I'm very excited about that.
That does sound exciting. And do you have... Also, I thought that you had something coming up on, it had to do with one of my favorite people in the world, Elvis Presley.
Well, I'm the consulting producer on a theatrical production, The King, The Final Hours, by Emmy Award-winning producer Mark Macias, who has a lot of TV credits and had a long career in TV. And that played on Broadway a few years ago, and Mark's taken it to other parts of the country, and I've had a little cameo on it, and I'm kind of proud of that.
I'll
let you know when it's going to be playing again.
Oh, that would be great. I would love that. And it's, you've got such an interesting background. You're so varied.
Thank you.
I mean, you're a writer, you're a filmmaker, you're an editor and a journalist, and that's such a wide range of skill. And you really, I'm very pleased to have you on my podcast, because I want our listeners to hear that there's so many different talents and skills that maybe at one time we thought were important, and then they just kind of, we stopped using them. We didn't have a need to use them, and we lose them. And you know, yeah, it goes back to that philosophy, the brain has use it or lose it. So for any listeners out there today that have been inspired or have thought of a talent or a skill that you have, but you haven't been tapping into, I encourage you, you know, think about it, tap into it, just touch it once. And if it feel good, then maybe you'll touch it again. Well, John Aidenburn, thank you so much for being my guest. It's been a joy conversing with you. It's been a joy learning about everything that you do and will do.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
On behalf of Lee Richardson and the Brain Performance Center, we want to thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more episodes like this, visit us on iTunes, Google Play, TogiNet, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and thebrainperformancecenter.com.